This is a HeadGum Podcast.
Today's show is sponsored by Miracle Made. Now, you guys have heard me talk about these sheets before. Guys, they're sheets. They have self-cooling properties for better quality sleep. And they were inspired by NASA. So they have all these like fancy thermoregulating qualities because they're all technology and stuff. And honestly, like, I feel like I spent so much of my life just buying the crappiest sheets. And when you find sheets that feel delightful, that's something you hang on to. You know what I mean? You just hang on to that. I mentioned they're self-cooling. They're also self-cleaning. They prevent up to 99.7% of bacterial growth, leaving them staying cleaner and fresher 3 times longer than the average sheets. I can totally attest to that. Like I said, they're super comfortable. They feel luxurious, like nicer than sheets they use in 5-star hotels. For real. They're designed for your skin. And because of the bacteria thing, it doesn't cause breakouts and stuff, which is like actually a big issue for my husband. His face is very sensitive to that. And I'll tell you, these pillowcases have been doing wonders on his face. So go to trymiracle.com/fakethenation. Again, that's trymiracle.com/fakethenation to get Miracle Made sheets today. And whether you're buying them for yourself or as a gift for a loved one, if you order today, you can save over 40%. And if you use the promo code FAKETHENATION at checkout, then you'll receive 3 free towels and save an extra 20%. It's an incredible deal. And Miracle is so confident in their product, it's backed with a 30-day money-back guarantee. And if you aren't 100% satisfied, you'll get a full refund. So upgrade your sleep with Miracle Made. Go to trymiracle.com/FAKETHENATION and use the code FAKETHENATION to claim your free 3-piece towel set and save 40% off. Again, that's trymiracle.com/fakethenation. Treat yourself, and thanks so much to Miracle Made for sponsoring this episode.
Fake the Nation, episode 250.
Hello, hello. This is Fake the Nation, where we talk about news, we talk about politics, and where we take a gentle approach to the Oscars and say, hey, it was a weird show and it was a weird year, so those two things match up. I'm your host, Nagin Farsad, and yeah, I watched the Oscars, and I want to personally thank Glenn Close for doing debut on live television. That's the kind of we're only doing optimism energy that I want in my life, so Glenn, call me, let's get drinks. Today, we're going to talk about the presidential version of doing the butt, and that is completing the first 100 days. We'll also talk about masklessness, the census reformulating the House, and the pandemic baby bust. I am so excited about today's panel. So joining us from many times he's joined us, he's even substitute hosted the show when I've been in the middle of having babies. Just one. He is the host of the Radiotopia show, This Day in Esoteric Political History. He's so fun and delightful, and you've heard him on like just umpteen podcasts because he's so good at it. Ladies and gentlemen, it's Jody Avergan. Hey, Jody.
Thank you very much. That's quite the intro.
And joining us for the very first time, I'm so excited that she's coming on the show because I've been such a fan of her work for so long. She is the co-host of the Election Profit Makers podcast you should immediately be subscribing to. She's also a writer on that wonderful HBO Max show, Search Party. It is the wonderful Starley Kine. Hey, Starley.
Hi.
Hi, Starley.
Hey,
Jody. I'm not sure I ever knew how to pronounce your last name.
Yeah.
You just said it right now. In all these years.
Well, I always thought it was Klein, so there you go.
Oh, my God. I thought it was Klein for like... now and again, I think it's like my brain will go between Klein and Kine, and it's really stupid. Just a note before we get into the show. There may be some construction noise or a dog noise, or we don't know. It might just happen. Apologies in advance. We're recording from apartments. Okay. And I'm always looking for ideas on other people that you want to see on the show, guest ideas you might have. So always, always please email us at fakethenation@headgum.com. And I would love to hear from you. So fakethenation@headgum.com if you have any panelist ideas. And with that, we're just going to get into it with topic number one. Biden has completed his first 100 days, and in it, He signed 11 bills into law. He's written 42 executive orders. He's undone 62 actions taken by his predecessor, including recommitting the U.S. to the Paris Climate Agreement, halting the U.S. exit from the World Health Organization, and pausing construction of the border wall. COVID-19 cases are down by 73%, and over half the population has at least one dose of the vaccine. And this is probably maybe the biggest achievement of his first 100 days, he's continued to be a nice guy. My question for you both is, for the record, we're recording Wednesday afternoon before Biden's kind of pseudo State of the Union address tonight. So apologies, we will not have heard that as we talk about this. But Jody, so many caveats to this week's episode. So sorry. What? How many caveats can one woman give? But Jody, what do you think of Biden's first 100 episodes?
Well, first, I just like you pointing out that we're recording this before the speech, and so in theory he could say something in the speech. But, you know, this is not Trump, right? We kind of know what he's going to say. It's going to be a normal speech. Like with Trump, you really have to add that.
Right.
You really have to add that caveat because you never know. But you know, the main thing I think about here is, you know, this conversation that has broken out because it is merited about how Biden wants to, you know, quote unquote, go big and do big things. And I think if there's any kind of lesson that you've learned here, it's that doing big things and like normalizing doing big things allows you to do more big things, which is so different, I feel like, from how even just 10 years ago we thought about political capital or whatever as this like exhaustible thing. And if you use some, then you only have a certain amount left. And I think we're kind of realizing that political capital is like a renewable resource or something, right? And I just think it's remarkable how quickly it's been normalized. And obviously the pandemic has a big part to do with that. It has created the space in which there's big challenges. And so talking about big things feels like it meets the moment. But that's kind of where my head's at. And, you know, he's done some big things, but I'm also just sort of amazed at how much the window has shifted to just like understanding that, yeah, this is one of those moments.
Starly, where are you at with these first 100 days?
I'm impressed that he's not the president that you would expect to be open to doing big things fast. Like he's not, right. I feel like that's not what people thought he would be. I know there's lots of people who don't think it's enough, but I am generally impressed with the expectations of being an old white man. He seems more open and more flexible than his type.
Right.
I like that there's an urgency I feel like he has brought to his presidency in his way, where he's like, we have to quickly undo the damage that was done or try to undo the damage. And every day, when you're his age too, you have like a feeling of like every day really does count.
But like a low key, no drama urgency, which is obviously different from Trump, but also different from Joe Biden of like 20 years ago, who liked to mix it up, who liked to be in front of cameras, who liked to sort of like, you know, be out there. And that streak, you know, for whatever reason is not there. And it's like kind of amazing, given the demographic picture you're painting of who he is, to even like have changed over the course of your life, because, you know, it tends to be that like people are who they are. And I do think like Joe Biden is different temperamentally now than he was 15, 20, 30, 40, 50 years ago.
I agree. It feels like wisdom, which you don't actually like see in practice very much with the older people we have in government.
Yeah, and I also have to say that his old white manness is a little bit freeing, right? Because he can just sort of – he can be more progressive than Obama felt he could be. He could do more on race relations than maybe Obama felt he could. He can just – he is – it is freeing because it's in that way that our default notion of everything is just whiteness. Yeah. Like he gets to be that blank slate and then build off of that. And that's, I think, the weird benefit of having an old white man in office right now.
But like in comparison to like to Joe Manchin, who so set in his ways and so
rigid,
rooted and being an older white guy. I definitely agree that Biden has more freedom than Obama, but I didn't expect Biden to exercise that freedom.
Yeah,
that
that's exactly right. And, you know, and I just want to say, like, just to put a little bit of meat on the bones of what that freedom has entailed, it's entailed the American Rescue Plan, which is a $1.9 trillion plan. That means there's the Water and Energy and Highway Bills Act that's meant to be bipartisan. This is all stuff that he's going to supposedly talk about tonight in the State of the Union address. There's a bunch of earmarks in appropriation bills for getting bridges and roads done and rehabilitated. There's the jobs plan that just is hundreds of billions of dollars in and of itself. He wants to pay for pre-K and 3K and 4K preschool. He wants to pay for community college. I mean, there's a ton of stuff that he's trying to do. There's a ton of stuff like the American Rescue Plan that he has already done. And I also want to say, in terms of like the rescue plan money, what's really interesting is we're talking, you know, he's getting some criticism that like he's not bipartisan enough. And we could talk about that in a second. But I do want to say about this rescue plan money, like, for example, Florida plans on using that on environmental cleanup. Maine wants to build a broadband network. Lake County, Indiana wants to repair sewers and bridges. These are red states that are theoretically against any kind of expenditure ever. And they're using this money on a lot of their infrastructure development. And I think, I mean, and that to me is the kind of we wouldn't have seen that in the last president, because everything was a punishment, and it was state by state, right? Like, Biden doesn't care if it's a red state or a blue state that's going to spend this money. He's happy that states are going to spend this money to make things better. And I think that is coming out. But there is that outstanding question of, like, is he not bipartisan enough? Like, he came in on this, you know, promise of bipartisanship. And Jody, do you feel like he's delivering on that?
Well, I just think, what does that word mean? I mean, you have to understand that word means two.
Right.
That word means different things in the U.S. Senate and then in the country. And, you know, I think when Joe Biden said, I want to be bipartisan, maybe a bunch of senators, Republican senators, heard that as, oh, okay, you're going to bend over and take my positions for me. Or what I think we're realizing Biden meant was, when I'm going to be bipartisan, I'm going to do stuff that is broadly popular. And when you look among people, you know, and when you look at what he's proposing, a lot of the stuff he just listed, it is broadly popular. I mean, there's been a bunch of polling around the 100 days. And generally speaking, from COVID relief all the way through the child credits, not even credits, the child subsidies and infrastructure and, you know, all sorts of things are popular and bipartisan. And so I do think he's being bipartisan, just depending on how you define it.
It's I think you're right that, like, this idea that things are bipartisan not just because Ted Cruz agrees with them, right, or not, like, but if, like, a working family in Indiana and a working family in you know, California may agree on them, and something like the child subsidies is something that, yeah, it's really popular because everyone could use that cash who has a kid who's under a certain income bracket, and his job approval rating is 54%, which, by the way, his predecessor never touched that level. It's kind of low for, like, generally for presidents at this stage in their presidency, but we're more polarized than we've ever been. So he's got like a 90-something percent approval rating among Democrats, which is like crazy great, but he's got a much lower approval rating among Republicans, and so that's kind of what's bringing down our average. Starley, do you think that anything about his first 100 days is moving the needle with, like, red states and Republican voters? Do you feel like they're, like, where do you feel the country is in terms of, like, that January 6th moment of, like, you're stealing the election, you've stolen the election, this is not a legitimate president? Where do you think we are after 100 days?
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious, ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie.
Also, discover more than 60 add-ons every week, like breakfast, on-the-go lunch, snacks, and beverages to help you stay fueled and feel good all day long. What are you waiting for? Folks, I feel like I've mentioned this before, but I tried other services that I was displeased with. And then a neighbor of mine was trying Factor. I had pulled them aside in the hallway and I was like, what are you feeling about this Factor? And they were like, it is delicious. You should definitely do it. So then me and my husband did it and we loved it. They are chef-prepared meals that arrive to your door, and then in 2 minutes, you could be eating them. Like, it's so simple, and they're actually delicious. And for people like me who just sometimes, my schedule can be so maniacal between traveling in different cities and, you know, doing stand-up gigs. It's like I just don't have a typical schedule where I can plan, set aside time for cooking and all that stuff. So something like Factor really helps for me. The other thing that I love to do is try not to eat carbs. So they have a keto option, which is fantastic. It's super delicious. They use premium ingredients. You can get stuff with like filet mignon and shrimp and truffle butter and broccolini and asparagus, right? Like real ingredients. They're no fuss, no mess meals. They eliminate the hassle of having to prep. They're tailored to your schedule. You can customize your weekly meals with flexibility. You can pause or reschedule. I've actually done that. I've both paused and rescheduled. Factor is basically your solution for fast premium meals without the need for cooking. We're celebrating Earth Day all month long, and look out for the Earth Month Eats badge on the menu for the lowest carbon footprint meals. So here's what I think you should do. I think you should head to factormeals.com/fakethenation50 and use the code fakethenation50 to get 50% off your first month plus 20% off your next month. That's code fakethenation50 at factormeals.com/fakethenation50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active. I am the type of person that has subscribed to things and I have forgotten about those things. I have paid twice for a children's educational app, and I didn't know that I was paying twice for several months. Until that is, I discovered Rocket Money, and because I use Rocket Money, it just showed up all these things. The thing that I was paying twice for that made me incredibly angry, thank God, Rocket Money ended that for me. It also cancels the subscription for you, so you don't have to like go through the hassle of going to that site and figuring out how to cancel. They actually make canceling very difficult. I don't know if any of you have had the experience, but I have been on a roundabout 8-exit nightmare trying to unsubscribe to something before. Rocket Money eliminates that hassle. It also alerts you to an increase in subscription price. And this is something Rocket Money did for me. It negotiates a lower price for something you already subscribed to. So like for my cable bill, it got me a lower price. And I was very happy about that. Nearly 75% of people have subscriptions that they've forgotten about, which makes me feel better because I'm one of them. But it makes me feel terrible because what are we doing? Losing that money. I don't want to waste that money. And I know you don't want to waste that money. If you struggle with these kinds of purchases, if you struggle with finances in general, Rocket Money will help you with the budgeting, help you track your expenses, help you, like I said, cancel those unwanted subscriptions. It's a personal finance app that finds and cancels unwanted subscriptions. It monitors your spending. It helps you lower your bills so you can get back to saving. I mean, me and my husband have been on the warpath, and Rocket Money has been a really big part of that. It has over 5 million users with over $500 million in canceled subscriptions. The average member has saved up to $740 a year using the app's features, which is, I mean, that tracks for me. So stop wasting money on things you don't use. Cancel your unwanted subscriptions. Go to rocketmoney.com/fakethenation. Again, that's rocketmoney.com/fakethenation. Save the money at rocketmoney.com/fakethenation.
Well, I don't know. I don't know if those people I consider the other party, though. Like, I think they're part of, I think they're Republicans, but I don't know.
They're too fringe.
I hope so. I don't think they're as fringe as we think they are. I think there's more of them than we think. But I don't think those are the people we should be appealing to when we talk about bipartisanship. That's what shouldn't be catered to in any way. I think the fear was that we thought he was going to be too bipartisan and too compromising. And actually, like when they were passing the relief bill, he said he was willing to compromise, but he said what the Republicans brought to him was a joke. And that he'll take them seriously.
If they take it seriously. Yeah.
And so the country seems to have gotten to the point of believing the election was, you know, fraudulent because of 4 years of Trump wearing them down to get to that point. I don't think that was the baseline that we started at 4 years before. And so I think when it comes to appealing to red states, there's always going to be this divide. But if Biden can keep doing things that benefits everyone, there's just going to be, he'll start to crack it a little bit where maybe he can bring some over to his side the way people who always voted red ended up voting for Obama. Like, right. I just think it's about helping people. And if he actually, if there's more of him just giving people stuff that they need and want, that I think will be louder than,
right.
And he's not having to compete with people saying, with Trump wearing them down every day.
Right. And I think the Trump wearing them down every day thing is like a pretty big deal, like that we haven't had that. And I feel part of that,
still Fox.
That you, and so just like, and I don't mean to drudge you by a point on this, but like, the Biden averages 6 tweets per day compared with Donnie, who by one count spent more than 9 full days of his presidency on Twitter, like that they calculated it. And so the amount of just public interface, I think, is so much less. And I think part of the way that that's manifesting itself is that if you look at, you know, like last week, there was like that whole red meat panic shit that was going on, that they took some part of Biden's speech and just did a nice false information campaign that Biden wants to get rid of 90% of your meat consumption or something, and that wasn't correct and blah, blah, blah. So they talked about how Biden's going to do that on all of the conservative networks, and then they issued like one really teeny tiny correction that was wrong. But what was really funny to me about that was like, oh, there's just not enough incendiary crazy talk for them to latch on to with Biden. So they really have to kind of scrape the bottom of the barrel for a meat panic. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. That isn't even true. And so in that sense, I feel like if that's any indicator, I feel like there is a little bit more of a calm that has come over the entire nation, regardless of party. And I don't know if that's just the view from my apartment or what, you know, but that's how it feels, Jody.
Yeah, I mean, you know,
final thoughts on this.
At this point into Obama's presidency, there was a like coalesced Tea Party that was marching in lockstep with Fox News. And right now, Fox News does feel like it's flailing a little bit. So I agree.
Right.
That said, I do think that's the biggest challenge is just, you know, Biden's not going to be able to fix that. It's not his. On the one hand, it's not his job to fix the fact that the Republican Party has gone around the bend, but it is also going to be his problem to deal with. And I don't, you know, and I do think that's still out there.
Yeah. Well, folks, let me know what you think of his first 100 days. And by the time this podcast airs, you will have heard his State of the Union address, or what is it technically called? It's not technically called a State of the Union address.
It's a joint congressional address or something, right?
His whatever of the Union address. Let me know what you thought of it on all of the social medias that we should all be staying off of. Please reach me. In the meantime, we're going to take a quick break. And when we come back, we will talk about other things. And we are back and we're ready for topic number 2. As of Tuesday, the CDC came out and said we don't have to wear masks outside. More specifically, fully vaccinated Americans don't need to cover their faces anymore unless they're in a big crowd of strangers. And those who are vaccinated can go outside without masks in some situations, too. I mean, I don't know. Starly, what did you think of the news? How'd that make you feel?
I mean, I'm glad. I'm happy about it.
You
I mean,
you don't?
I,
you
but
mean
I,
you want this thing to end, Starly?
Yeah.
So you have some hesitation. You have some hesitation in admitting that. Yes. Tell me why you might hesitate admitting that.
Am I supposed to be excited about that? I'm so excited. I hate wearing masks. I never want to wear a mask again. But I'm not. My behavior in the pandemic was I was a good citizen. Everything was for
right.
to be a good citizen, to not give it to others and hence not get it, so I don't give it to others. I was not on either extreme. I was not someone who was out in the world like feeling fear all the time.
Right, when right.
I wasn't looking for the hand sanitizer at everywhere I went. I wasn't. I was being careful and I was being good, but I felt
you were following
like,
the science, but you weren't freaking out.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I'm super worried about not enough people getting vaccinated and that trend. So the part where, I guess non-vaccinated people can mix it up too. That kind of stuff makes me nervous because I want everything to just be like, you must get vaccinated. You must get vaccinated. But yeah, I hate those masks.
Right. And I, just so you
so
feel,
ready to be
just
done.
So you're, I also hate the mask. It's interesting because I think we're in a weird cultural moment where a lot of people feel really weird admitting that they fucking hate the mask. I fucking hate the mask. I just want to say to all fellow glasses wearers in America and the world, the mask in the winter was a tough one because you only saw fog in your glasses. Like that's what it was for several months. And that sucked. And so, and I would routinely just have to take like breathing breaks so my glasses could defog so that I could see something. And I tried everything. So we don't need to go into that. I did try everything. The glasses, there were some instances where I could get the glasses to fog up less, but it was still just a constant battle. So, and I also just like the knowing the way molecules work and talking, you know, I have a bunch of doctors in my family who were always like, wear your mask in public because it's what we're doing right now to protect everybody, to also encourage everybody to do it, which I feel the same way. I feel like I was a good citizen. I am a good citizen. I will do the things. I will follow the science. And in this case, I will also follow the science because I'm probably not going to wear a mask outside. Because I don't have to. Also, I'm fully vaccinated. And then the other bigger news, Jody, came out today as we tape on Wednesday here. I'll just read from the Johns Hopkins press release about this. The emerging data confirms what many of us thought would be the case, that not only do vaccines stop symptomatic COVID, but they also make it highly unlikely that someone can even be infected at all. I think the preponderance of evidence supports the fact that vaccinated individuals are not able to spread the virus. Jody, yeah. What do you think?
Well, I'm happy about that too. All this is good.
Yeah, it's all good.
I just want to, you know, go on the record as saying I would like the pandemic to end, I would like to get back to real life. But you know, I mean, I think your point there about, you know, this is something we thought was true, and we just sort of needed to wait until we got, you know, I think that is like important to keep in mind, and I think is like. We probably knew 8 months ago, 6 months ago, that wearing masks outside wasn't the like be all and end all of this. And we know that the CDC is sometimes a little slow or cautious or however you want to clarify. And I just think like people who follow the science and are reasonable and are trying to be like civic minded, part of that is understanding that there is a little inefficiency in the process and how we move forward. And I have been like super frustrated with this like outdoor mask, quote unquote, like controversy, because it just feels like a total straw man. It feels like people who want to get angry about COVID regulations somehow drew this like arbitrary line in the sand around outdoor masks. Like, I don't think that's actually where the real debate is happening, but it is like easy fodder for the outrage machine. And so like, I just, you know, again, I'm just like this outdoor mask thing. Like, yeah, we knew where it was headed it's fine. And in the context of like 2 years and in the context of trying to be a little responsible for a global pandemic, like 3 extra weeks where we knew where this was headed, but you know, fine.
But did it right.
It's fine.
And I just want to say, too, you know, I did an informal, obviously non-scientific poll on Twitter and on Instagram about whether or not people felt good about not wearing masks. And, you know, it wasn't, I don't know if it was like maybe sort of evenly divided with people being like, yeah, I'm so glad taking the mask off, to like people being like, no, I don't trust that people are going to be truthful about their vaccination status. But just to point out, there's also situations where unvaccinated people can be maskless outside, whatever. But putting that aside, there is I personally don't like care if someone wants to continue wearing a mask or not wearing a mask. Yeah. That's the other thing. I think there's been phases of judgment throughout this pandemic, and both have been frustrating. The phase of judgment where if you were wearing a mask, you were some kind of like crazy liberal who was a zombie to the Democrats or something. That was dumb and stupid. And then the phase where people are like, if you're not wearing a mask, you are just, you hate other people and you don't care about safety and all of that. All, both of those things are heinous. And I think if you want to continue wearing a mask, it's like worked out for you, or you haven't, you know, you're extra, you have other health concerns that I'm not, you know, that the average person doesn't have, all of that stuff. That's great. Like, keep wearing a mask. I totally support you. And I want to say the average person supports you, like, you know, unless they're Tucker Carlson or something, I don't know. But I mean, I think, again, you're right, Jody. What's frustrating about this is that it's like there's actually no need for outrage anywhere of it, like in any angle on it. Like, we don't really need the outrage. It's like, you're really useless.
I got the news alert came on my phone, like the New York Times alert came in, and like it was like a continuous movement of the alert coming in and me taking my mask off. It was so quickly done. Like, unlocked my phone, took with my left hand, took my mask off with my right hand.
Think some people...
there was no air in between.
And some people are going to, like, do a ton of reading and thinking on their own and find their own line. Some people are going to take that CDC guidance and just, like, not necessarily because they think the CDC is, you know, the be-all and end-all, but, like, you have to just sort of, like, take your guidance from somewhere. And some people have just very reasonably said, whatever the CDC says, that's what I'm going to follow. But, you know, I just think that this, like... masks outdoors, quote unquote, debate doesn't really exist outside of the minds of people who want to find something to get angry about. Like, I really just don't. I think there's plenty of other reasonable arguments and like conversations and tricky, tough things. The masks outdoors thing, I just think is just a straw man.
On that note, let me know, folks. What do you think? What are you doing? You don't have to. And also, whatever you think, I support you. Yeah. It's totally fine because it doesn't matter. Okay. I mean, it matters. Like, in the grand scheme. Also, get vaccinated. Help people get vaccinated. Yeah.
Unless you're one of the protesters, like, blocking people from, like, going into stores because they're wearing masks.
I don't support those people. Yes. Yeah. But in general, I just support people, like, making their own reasonable choices within the realm of, like, kindness and reason. Okay, let us move on to the next topic. So the census was taken, for better or worse, in the middle of a fucking pandemic, and I was so mad at this because the only thing that seemed like it couldn't happen really smoothly was a fucking census taking in the pandemic. And the only thing that muffled the sound of my screams was empty census forms. Nevertheless, here we are. And as a result, there's been a reapportionment of seats in the House. As a result, some delegations are now going to be smaller. Some are going to be larger. So just to give you a little rundown, West Virginia, North Carolina, Michigan, Illinois, Pennsylvania, California, and New York State have all lost one seat. I want to point out that New York State lost a seat by just 89 counts. If 89 more people had filled the census form, we would have kept that seat. It is more than frustrating. How is that not in the margin of error, by the way? I don't understand how that works. That's like, someone needs to explain that to me. But the gains at fucking 89. Okay. Anyways, that makes me so, I can't. I'm so mad at the number 89. Don't anyone say 89 to me. I'll just self-combust. Here are some states that are gaining. Texas.
Great year
gains.
For movies.
Yeah. It sounds like it would have been a great year for movies. But I can't even talk about that anymore because I'll just like explode. Texas gained two seats. Florida gained a seat. Colorado, North Carolina, they all gained a seat. I guess my just like large question is, what do you think of these results? What do you think it means? Jody?
Well, I don't want to say the number that comes after 88. by the way, Star Lee, Field of Dreams, yeah. Major League, Parenthood, Do the Right Thing, Say Anything, Uncle Buck. Oh, you're right. Fuck. This is a lot.
Oh, yeah.
This is a good year.
It's an incredible year.
All right. Anyway, New York has lost congressional seats basically every census, right? In the 40s, New York had 45 congressional seats. New York is now down to 26. Worth keeping that context in mind. The population of this country is moving to the South and the Southwest, and away from the Northeast and the Midwest. And so I think we see that. The way that this will actually shake out is going to be when the state legislatures rewrite the census, when they re-gerrymander. And so, to say like, oh, red states gained and blue states tended to lose, that's sort of true. But, if you look at who has control, Republicans have full control of the redistricting process in more states than Democrats do, but they have less of that control than they did in 2010. And so, you kind of have to like – see how this actually plays out. Yeah. And, for what it's worth, I will say.
And the one seat in New York that could be done away with is a Republican seat.
Yes, absolutely. And New York is controlled by Democrats.
Maybe bluer overall.
They're going to rewrite it to we lost a seat. Lo and behold, it's a Republican seat. And that's going to happen in New York, guaranteed. I will say, for what it's worth, that you have to draw the line somewhere. So yes, 89 seems like a small number, but like you got to draw it somewhere. And it doesn't matter if you lose it by 10,000 or 89, you still lose it. You either lose it or you don't. And so, I know that that's like been the headline, but it is, it is what it is.
The other frustrating thing, Joe, and this, I have to say this too, on top of that number, 88 plus one, is the fact that New York's population grew during this time. It just didn't grow at the same rate, right? Yeah. Like as Texas. And so that's the other frustrating thing that sort of like, it feels like it defies math, except for it doesn't. I totally understand. But it's really fucking angering on top of 88 plus one. Starley, what do you think?
When Harry Met Sally
really
came out in 1989.
So traditionally they say 1995 and I think 2017 are the best years for movies ever, but 1989.
What happened? What was 2017?
Oh, that's my 2017 was There Will Be Blood. No, not 2017. What year was that? Was that 2007? Sorry, 2007.
Because 2017 is basically this year.
Right. 2007
was with movies.
2007 was No Country for Old Men, There Will Be Blood, Michael Clayton, a bunch of very, very good movies. But anyway, go ahead.
Yeah, rewatchable.
But thing. I bet on average 1989, the difference between 1989 and 2007 was still having this happen, but not as much as in 1989, is even the bad movies the lesser movies you saw were still pretty good.
Fair enough.
And that is what decreases every year. Yes.
And that is what the House of – and that's what Congress is all about.
Very similar to leaking congressional seats from New York over the –
Starley, what do you think about the reapportionment?
It's very hard for me to wrap my head around how it practically shakes out. As far as the census being taken, the census was already being taken, so I understand why it continued to be taken during the pandemic.
I just think it needed I should have gotten like an extra year or, you know what I mean? Like there's no way the census numbers are totally off from their projections of what they would be, which is a red flag. I mean, I just want a do-over. I just want a do-over.
A do-over seems reasonable. I don't know. I know that California lost a seat, even though Democrats lost. It wasn't as bad a loss as we feared.
Right. And also, I just want to say to take a census during a presidency that actively was trying to thwart populations from completing the census.
They kept going.
Do over, folks. Hashtag census do over, please.
You're making a list of do overs that you want from the last four.
Right. Exactly. I was going to say on that list, though, I think I'm sure this conversation has been had in the White House. I understand. Given that administration, I understand why they continued the census during a pandemic in the hopes of not getting an accurate reading. But I think as much as I'm sure the idea of a do-over has been lobbed around the White House. I think it's so low on the list that we might not.
I know, because people don't understand. People don't understand how sexy the fucking census really is. They don't. It's like not glamorous. It is, in fact, one of the most glamorous things about democracy. And it just has a really terrible PR. Like, the census just seems so fucking boring.
Well, there needs to be a Aaron Sorkin movie about it.
Mm. Well, and maybe we get Aaron Sorkin to do a 1989 movie in 2021 about the census.
He would love it. He would love it.
Folks, let me know where you are on reapportionment. You know where I am. I'm really mad and I want to do over. And 89 is not an appropriate number to be the cutoff. I just want to say that for the record. It's within the margin of error, because that means tens and tens of thousands of people are going to lack representation where they once had it. You know? Come on. Okay.
I mean, again, what's more democratic than that in this country?
All right. Let's get into topic number three. Birth rates are down. They're down in France by 7%. They're down in Poland by 5.3%. They're down in Italy. They're down in China by nearly 15%. In the U.S., there's an estimated 300,000 fewer babies expected in 2021, and there was already 7% fewer births in December. So my question is, guys, where is all the raw dogging? Where has all the raw dogging gone? Why the decline?
I have so many theories about this. This also seems, this does not seem unrelated to the previous segment.
Yeah, no, true.
You really are determined to make the census sexy. Yeah. I am sort of relieved that there's less people having babies, just because I'm tired of everyone I know having babies. So that's a selfish reason.
You're tired of having to buy what, like the obligatory onesie?
And I think there's too many people. They can buy their onesies. Yeah. I'm tired. It's more I'm tired of seeing the social media posts, mm-hmm. mostly. I think it's so scary to have kids now. It's scary just the state of the world, but I think it's not a given anymore at all that your children will have a higher quality of life than their parents.
Before I throw to you, Jody, I just want to say, I want to pat myself on the back for a moment and by pointing out that I don't actually post very much about my own child.
I knew that was going to. I could feel the pause.
I have one, and I probably post about her and the dog like in equal amounts, and I try mm-hmm. not to post very much about either, just because I don't want to be that guy. Jode, but no, I don't care if you are that person. But I just want to say I have created a standard for myself of like minimal posting about child.
That's good. I respect that.
Thank you.
Others should follow your lead. It's not that posts about people's kids are not interesting and not fun to look at, because I actually do like looking at them. It's that they create the feeling that it's the only
correct
option.
Way to live or something.
Yes. And that's, there's actual damage that it does.
Right.
And you can feel, and sometimes it's like, did this parent have an especially terrible day because they cannot be saying enough times how this is the greatest thing that's ever happened to them.
Yeah.
Like it's almost
creating this baby bust, just the the reverse psychological effect of like what you think it would do. It's like doing the opposite. Jody, what do you think about this population decline?
I will say I post photos of my daughter all the time. I find her very charming. Mm-hmm. And, you know, you're just going to have to deal with it, people. But no. but I mean, I think
the close friend.
Yes, exactly. Starley, mm-hmm. I mean, I think your point about this notion of, you know, envisioning what the world will look like for the next generation is really at the heart of a lot of this. And I think when I thought about having a kid, I certainly thought that, and even like talked to people about like, is this a responsible thing to do? And, you know, actually a lot of people I respect sort of answered that, yes, like we need smart, caring people to be having kids. Like that's part of actually the solution, not mm-hmm. like, you know, so that's part of it. But if I can just add one more thing, which is like,
yeah, yeah.
At the same time, I also feel like every generation of parents must feel like they are having their kid at a time of real peril. Like, I look at the generations in my family, and like my parents, like I was, my parents had me when like the notion that the US and Russia would like annihilate each other in a nuclear war was like very present in their lives. My grandparents had my parents in, you know, 1945, like during a world war. So I think like every parent probably fears that like my kid, there might not be a world when my kid grows up. And so I on the one hand, I like kind of understand that that is out there right now and for real. But I also think that that is off. I feel like that's often been the case.
But not financially.
Yes.
Financially.
Yes, exactly.
The financial part is what has changed. The given that your kids were going to have a better life, that you were providing, you were having kids in order to provide them with a life, and then they would.
Yes. And that across the board is like a defining feature for, you know, millennials who are the ones who are having kids right now, that just like a lack of faith in like American, you know, advancement in that way. Absolutely. I think that's huge. Yes. You're right.
Yeah.
I mean, the other weird thing is that we have set up this thing that your life is supposed to be better than your parents' life, which also is sort of like anti-sustainability, right? Like your life, and what is the metric of your life being better? Does it mean you have more things? It means you've traveled to more places? Like all of those things are not sustainable. So I have trouble with that metric to begin with. Like my life should not be better than my parents' life. It should just be like similarly situated to my parents' life, but then more thoughtful because they burned a bunch of fossil fuels and I hope to burn less, you know? And like, so I think, I don't know, like that metric, I think it's weird, but you're right that in terms of fertility rates in the United States, one of the things I found is that there's residual effects of from the Great Depression. So in October 2009, the Pew Research Center reported that 14% of Americans between 18 and 34 and 8% between 35 and 44 were postponing having a child because of the financial crisis. And the other thing I also want to point out, and this might just be a little bit more of a cultural change, is women giving birth in their late 30s and 40s is actually the only number in the fertility world that in the birth rate world that has gone up, right? So more women are having children in their 30s and 40s, but when you start so late, you can't have a whole brood. You know, generally speaking. So that also kind of leads to the overall decline, even though this particular age group is putting in the work. And I'm in that age group of like, I had a baby, you know, I waited like until later. I waited till I could have, until I did a whole bunch of shit that felt baby incompatible. And then I had a baby so that I could start living a baby compatible life, which is a cultural thing in general. I mean, I think there's a convergence of pandemic and financial crisis and women who were just like making decisions that are also just maybe more culturally accepted. It's like not as big a deal. Like I have tons of friends who are not having kids. And it's like, very much ho-hum, you know, where I think in my parents' generation, it was not remotely ho-hum to make that choice.
It's interesting, though, because I feel, so the thing about the having better life than our parents, we don't have to have a better life, although capitalism, I feel like, kind of makes you feel like is that model where it's always got to be,
right.
You always gross, are being gross, driven gross. Towards this unsustainable outcome. But the kids today are not, it's not the same given as what their parents had. You're not guaranteed to own a home.
Right.
They go into college, you know, and they're going to have all this debt. They're not being assured the thing that you're saying you want to have, which is like the same level of life as your parents. I feel with my social circles, people might have had kids. It might have been, you know, the thing you were expected to do in past generations. Everyone had kids, but they seem like once they had the kids to generally be like, now I have the kids, they can kind of, they're not taking over my entire life.
Right, like they do whatever. Yeah.
And now my friends who have kids, it is their life.
Yeah.
It is there's exceptions, but there seems to be tremendous amount of pressure amongst the people I know to have children, because if you don't have the kids, how are you going to ever see anyone again as an adult? Because most adults I know with kids don't do anything that's not related to their child. They work, and then their social life is devoted to the child, and they're very close with their children, and they're very determined to make it so their kids have all the things and all the access. And it doesn't, if societally as a whole, we're being expected, there's less pressure on us to have children.
That like the whole way, the cultural norm of parenting has become super annoying. Like, not just that it's annoying, like that helicopter parents are annoying, whatever, just that like the expectation of like what you're supposed to do as a parent has become way more intense, and it's now like not everyone's thing, you know, whereas before I agree that my parents were way, my immigrant Muslim parents, that we had a ton of rules, I had a ton of restrictions, etc., but they were just generally way more chill as parents than basically everyone, every parent that I see on the playground, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
And like, you know, and they raised the little like overachiever, blah, 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 but still they were just way more chill. And I also think that their lives were more integrated. Like they would just, it's not that like they didn't go to parties. They did go to parties, and they would just take me with them, and I would just like go watch TV in someone's random house. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And
then there'd be their people, identity was less.
It was just tied into whatever I was doing. I was a little bit. Sometimes they treated me like just an accessory they had to drag around or whatever. Sometimes they did things for me very specifically and, you know, really like thoughtfully. Sometimes there were, you know, it was a mixture of the two. Like it, you know, like I was in that 80s and 90s, like latchkey kid generation where like I spent a lot of time alone at home, you know, without parents there. And that kind of thing just doesn't happen anymore. So our expectation of parenting, I do agree, seems to have like blown up in a way that's so that feels like it, you know, it's a hurdle for people to join. Yeah. You know, Jody, what do you think?
I think that makes sense to me. My sense, maybe this is projecting, but you know, I wonder if we're moving a little bit back away from the helicopter parent generation. I feel like that sort of Gen X, older millennial sort of vibe was definitely, I don't know, maybe, you know, again, maybe I'm projecting here, maybe, you know, but I do feel like maybe younger millennials, like I do think there's a little bit of a natural cycles that you go latchkey, helicopter, right. And maybe we're moving in the other direction.
Right. Yeah. I just throw my baby into a living room and just leave. So that's how I'm doing it.
I feel like it's less so about helicopter parenting and more about the identity of being a
parent. And social media is not.
And it's
not
more
helpful.
About.
Right.
Yeah. And also the feeling of, like, when you said, when you talked to your friends and they were like, no, kind, caring people have to have kids.
Yeah.
I agree with that sentiment. But I think what we're also thinking is we're so used to being like us and them. For them to say that implies that unkind, not caring people are having kids. You know, it's like a balancing. It's kind of a balancing.
That's not
right?
Exactly how I read it. I mean, I hear what you're saying. I think it's more like, you know, any parent wants to imbue their kids with their values and hope that their kid is like a good, you know, citizen. And that when you see someone who has values that you know, are aligned with yours, then you want that person to do that.
Well, and Starley, like the South African philosopher David Benatar, we read this in a piece in the New York Times by Tom Wyman, and he started quoting the South African philosopher who is the preeminent antinatalist, by the way, anti-having kids. He likened baby making to like taking hostages and a strategy of on behalf of breeders to increase their value in the eyes of society. His case study, he points out if two people need a kidney and only one of them is the single mother of a young child, who does society think should get the kidney? Obviously, we give it to the mother of a young child, right? Because that person's value is just inherently greater because they procreate it. So that's kind of like what you're saying, is we're sort of like valuing people, parents, in this ridiculous way.
Yes. Yeah. That exactly.
So, Jody, final thought for you. Does this bust worry you? Like, do you think it's like we're gonna go into an era of population decline in general?
I just don't feel like I know enough to really be worried. I mean, I generally am not a like the world is overpopulated and we need to really decrease our population and that's the only way we're going to, you know, I generally think like humans solve problems and if there are more humans, they will solve, you know, they will maybe be more in problems, a better shape yeah. to solve problems. So, you know, it worries me a little bit, but I also don't see it as like necessarily inevitable. And, you know, I could see it cycling in the other direction for all host of reasons.
Yeah. And I just want to say in closing, like, I kind of like, you know, my take on Starley's position is I totally think people should have kids and also to feel free not to make it a big deal.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? You know, it is a big deal, but like it also, you know, it doesn't like have to be, you know, it's like we can live in that like 1988 plus one movie where having a kid was just like a thing. It just was like a part of the movie. All right. Thank you so much for joining us. Starley, where do people find you?
Starley Kine, Twitter, Starley Kine, Instagram.
Great. And then you can also listen to her podcast.
Yeah. Election Profit Makers. You can watch Search Party.
Jody, where do people find you?
I host a short political history show called This Day in Esoteric Political History. You can find that wherever you find your podcasts. I am also on Twitter and Instagram and Jody Avergan.
And folks, you know where to find me and all the stuff that I do. Just a note, I did an episode on cicadas with Star Talk that is out right now. So you can listen to me and Neil deGrasse Tyson and a scientist who knows everything about cicadas talk about cicadas. It's actually really great. You know what cicadas do? They fucking do a bunch of fucking. That's what they do. And then also, I'm on this week, the episode that just happened of Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me. Also, you can still find me on Bird Girl every Sunday night. So tune in to the Cartoon Network for your regularly scheduled Adult Swim viewing Bird Girl on Sunday nights. And I want to thank everyone who makes this show possible. A big thank you to our producer, Julia Linden, our sound engineer, Stephanie Aguilar, and all the wonderful people at HeadGum. The theme music was written by Gabby Alter. And as always, please rate and review the show on Apple Podcasts because it helps other people find it. Again, email us at fakethenation@headgum.com. Let us know your guest ideas, your segment ideas, anything, any ideas. Hit us up. We love hearing from you. Join the Patreon because it helps the show. It helps me. You get a bunch of bonus content and you can do that at patreon.com/NagineFarsad. And thanks so much for listening to the show. We'll be back in your earballs next week.
That was a HeadGum podcast.